listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from the Latin America and Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. Let's just jump in. There's plenty going on, and it's been a while, so take it away.
Well, and obviously the main story for most people of progressive views is what's happening in Venezuela.
Yeah.
But I think as we look at the detail of the developing U.S. attack against Venezuela, it increasingly seems to bear out what you and I were talking about in a previous couple of programs. We haven't spoken for some time now, but in our previous conversations we were talking about how unlikely it is that the United States is going to get any kind of clean cut victory from their point of view in Venezuela in terms of regime change. And that's been borne out by the events of the last couple of months, and as the attacks, as the resistance and the resilience of President Nicolas Maduro's government becomes clearer and clearer to people observing what's going on, the United States authorities get, and in particular, of course, Elliot Abrams and John Bolton and Mike Pompeo, become more and more desperate because their utterances and declarations of the previous two or three months are looking more and more stupid with every day that goes by.
They're like completely removed from reality. It's like there's a virtual presidency there for this guy. It's not connected to the people. He can't collect more than 100 or 200 people in a rally at this point inside Venezuela. The biggest challenge now, it appears, is for the Venezuelan security forces to protect him from Venezuelan people, because you know they're angry at him, and so their job is to protect him from what he's earned, basically. And meanwhile, you know, his wife who, and she's pretty young, so I thought she looked like maybe his daughter, is in Washington. The papers here are treating her as the first lady of Venezuela. Yeah. And again, there's no... I don't think she could park her car and not worry about getting ticketed in downtown Caracas just as an average citizen.
Sure. No, I think you're referring to an incident in which the Venezuelan police protected Juan Guaido from irate citizens who...
Yeah.
And Max Blumenthal, the reporter from the Gray Zone, who did a great job here in Nicaragua last year, he's doing a similarly very important job in Venezuela. He did a report that appeared on RT, and you may well have seen it, saying, what kind of dictatorship is it whose police protect the opposition trying to overthrow the government?
Right, I know.
And of course, but that goes to something fundamental it runs parallel to, and while we're talking about the reality of the events here in Latin America, in the United States, people are completely deceived by wall-to-wall false propaganda. And you correctly pointed out the U.S. media treating Juan Guaido's wife as if she were the first lady of Venezuela, and she gets to meet President Trump, et cetera, as if that's any kind of honor. But the thing is that that is what people in the United States perceive. That is their daily news.
Right.
And here in Nicaragua, we had that all last year. I still have to deal with people that I know in the United States who think that we're in some kind of dictatorship here in Nicaragua.
Yeah.
Completely absurd.
Well, remember in Venezuela, right after the National Assembly elections in December of 2015, the Capriles, I think, who was the leader of the opposition at the time, one of the leaders, Lopez, one of them, was basically saying, okay, now that we've won a majority in the National Assembly, we're going to step up and run this dictator out of town. It's like, you mean right after the you guys got elected as opposition to the government, you're looking at the government as a dictator? You're calling the government a dictator still?
Yeah,
What the hell is that?
It is completely insane. And it's like dealing, trying to, for me, for anybody who's ever dealt with people or relatives suffering from dementia, that is what it's like trying to talk to people in the United States about Latin America, because they have completely demented ideas about the reality in the region.
Yep.
And we can continue to harp on that, but it probably makes more sense to explain the nitty-gritty of that by looking at from one country to the next at what's going on. So in Venezuela, you have a government that has mass support, and despite everything, despite the continuing attacks, despite the disruption and sabotage of the electricity system by the United States and its cyber warfare units, and despite the direct sabotage by paramilitaries that have been infiltrated into the country from Colombia, despite all that, the government of Nicolas Maduro is still carrying on, and they're meeting the needs of the people in a way that most governments in Latin America are not doing,
right?
Meeting the social, despite everything. And let's look, for example, at Argentina. Argentina is in complete meltdown economically, and they've got poverty now is supposed to be around 32% in Argentina, right? This is a member of the OECD.
Right.
It's a member of the G20. It's one of the wealthiest countries in the South.
Right.
And there they are. They've got 32% poverty. What on earth is? Why is that not being reported?
Right.
And they have an economic crisis as a direct result of Mauricio Macri's ridiculous neoliberal economic policies, backed to the hilt by the International Monetary Fund, of course.
Right.
And so there you have Argentina in social and economic meltdown, but that's not making the news anyway.
I mean, what really ought to make the news is the fact that this occurred. This is a change that's taken place in the last 3 years. In other words, you could map a huge increase, a crisis increase in poverty in Argentina from December of 2015 when Macri was elected and instituted these policies. That is certainly newsworthy. It's not like some long, slowly evolving story, but rather the kind of thing that ends up should be on the front page.
Yeah, and then the other thing, of course, is that Macri's government is irredeemably corrupt, and that is the worst aspects of that are now coming out, where you have a Macri supporter, very clearly a supporter of the Macri government. He's involved in the justice system. I think he's an investigating judge, caught up in very serious extortion charges, right? Mm-hmm. There's very little focus on that, if any focus at all, in Western, certainly corporate media or alternative media either. Right. And that what gets reported are the charges against, the ridiculous charges against Cristina Kirchner, but you don't actually. This is the flip side, if you like, of the demented news coverage that people get of Latin America in the United States, whereby every progressive leader is a dictator, and anything that it looks makes a right wing government like Mauricio Macri's look bad gets suppressed. So that's the situation in Argentina, and look at what's happening in Brazil. In Brazil, you've got a president who is now trying to celebrate the military coup of 1964.
Right.
And the justice system in Brazil, to their credit, issued a judgment that it would be illegal for him to celebrate that anniversary, which is what he wanted to do. I think he went ahead and did it anyway.
Right.
And there are unlikely to be any consequences about that. But what that means is that in a very real sense, the United States is promoting a return to the 1970s dictatorships, and they don't have the form of dictatorships that come to power via military coup, because it's all a little more subtle now. But as we can see in Venezuela and also in Nicaragua and the rhetoric against Cuba, and the subtlety is only a veneer. Underneath, the ideological drive and towards repression, and the denial of democracy and the denial of fundamental rights for the great majority of people in Latin America, that is still the same as it ever was.
It's actually worse in a way than an actual military coup, because in the case of an actual military coup, there is usually some back and forth between the population and the military where the people resist. Here, what you're doing, in fact, is creating consent for the conditions, in other words, an affirmation of a military coup as a valid way of achieving policy and putting the people on, you know, more or less on game with that policy. You create manufacturing consent.
Yeah, and I think I think the jury's out on how far Bolsonaro has any real popular support, in the same way that, because he cheated people, he defrauded people with his election campaign.
And Lula was in jail, by the way. Lula couldn't run. The most popular guy couldn't run either.
Correct, and if you look at what the mobilization that's going on in Brazil, and it's taking some time to get momentum and get force, certainly the force necessary to pose a serious challenge to the Bolsonaro government in policy terms, in terms of resisting what Bolsonaro is trying to do, so, and privatize everything, cut back social services and social provision in education and healthcare. And people in Brazil are waking up to that, and I think we're likely to see over the next year, 18 months, a strongly resurgent popular movement. But staying with where we are right now, and if you look at what's happening in somewhere like Uruguay, for example, Uruguay is a tiny country of 3-4 million people, but and it was a kind of very much an archetype of what a military dictatorship was like back in the 1970s. It was, you could see it in that very reduced space that is Uruguay. The meaning and the significance of a military dictatorship in economic terms, in social terms, in personal and moral terms was perhaps clearer even than it was in a larger country like Argentina. Now you have in Uruguay, you've had I think it's a former head of the armed forces trying to defend the dictatorship, and the president there, Tabaré Vázquez, has now felt obliged to dismiss his minister of defense and his the subsecretary for defense and also the heads of the armed forces because an internal military tribunal refused to bring measures against somebody who confessed to a heinous murder back in the days of the dictatorship. So, and what does that mean? That means that in Uruguay, and you can extrapolate from Uruguay to the broader southern cone, to Chile, to Argentina, and also to Brazil, of course, what that means is that the military don't care. They think that they're immune. They think, right. You know, these extreme fascists who are responsible for terrible crimes all through the 70s and the early 80s, they just don't care about public opinion or possible judicial consequences. Where does that come from? That comes from deliberate United States policy to promote a fascist. Let's call it what it is. This is a fascist agenda, the marriage of corporate power to political power, right, backed up by the military. That's what it is. Yep. And so you can see that very clearly in Uruguay. It's there, kind of latent in Argentina. It's less latent in Chile, right? And so that is a motif, a continental-wide motif, that we will see become clearer and clearer, in particular over the next year or so, as the United States policy in the region fails. They think that they've done quite well by co-opting governments in Argentina and Brazil, in particular. But as I said earlier, I think what we're likely to see over the next year or 18 months is a very strong resurgence of popular resistance to that. And the question then is the question that you and I asked ourselves back in late 2015 after Mauricio Macri's victory. And what is in the elections that year in Argentina, how are they going to maintain their political control once their economic policies smash into the wreck that we're seeing develop right now?
Right. No, I mean, and that's exactly the look. We pointed out then, we were looking backwards to how they had gotten there in the first place. You had the crisis in Argentina that led directly to Kirchner and then Cristina da Silva de Kirchner. You had essentially the same condition in Brazil, where you had the fascists and the neoliberal economics that led to a collapse that led essentially to Lula and to Dilma Rousseff. In other words, you had failure of right-wing governments with neoliberal economics that led to an uprising by the left. And again, the same in Venezuela. And all of these things are happening like in the 1990s, really, and coming into this century. And you had the construction for 10 to 20 to 25 years of infrastructure in the half of the population that had been left out of the development of the country for its entire history up to that point, building a constituency where you end up with the demographics in Brazil and Venezuela and Argentina, perhaps by somewhat different path, and even in Chile, where the population is evenly divided on the question of a left or a right-wing path. And right, the ground has been washing out under the feet of those who favored a right-wing path, because inevitably it does, because their program is to impose the old program that led directly to the left-wing resurgence.
Yeah, you can see that very much in Ecuador, can't you?
And
the recent elections, the sectional elections and the municipal elections
in Ecuador. There, yeah.
And the collapse of support for Lenin Moreno, and the resurgence of support for political movements that support former President Rafael Correa. And Ecuador is very much a case. And right now in Ecuador, you can see very clearly what I suggested is likely to happen over the next 12, 18 months. There's a very clear resurgence of grassroots opinion against what Lenin Moreno and his U.S. masters have tried to impose on Ecuador under the false pretenses of, you know, neoliberal policies will bring you prosperity. Only complete idiots believe that.
Right.
They managed to fool enough people in Argentina and elsewhere to believe that nonsense. And now you can see very clearly in Ecuador that political project is falling to bits before our very eyes. Now, so then one fundamental thing is, you know, if it is the regional right wing capable of reaching an agreement that they'll abide by. So, and if you look at events in Argentina, Brazil, Ecuador, Uruguay, all these places. The question is, will they play by the rules of the game, which the electoral game that up until the victory of Hugo Chavez, for example, in 1998, the United States had been able to dominate, and then with the election of people like Hugo Chavez, Evo Morales in Bolivia and other progressive leaders, Nestor Kirchner in Argentina, Lula da Silva in Brazil, with that wave of progressive political leaders winning the electoral game by the rules that had been imposed on the region by the United States, you know, supposedly championing democracy.
Right.
And the United States thought that the elites in the United States thought that they had things sewn up in the 1990s.
Right.
And in the early, and through the 2000s, they were shown to be completely wrong. And now the question is, will the right, that I perceive anyway, it's a fundamental question, is the right wing willing to play by those old rules and lose again?
Right. Right. In other words, if they lose the election, will they walk out of the office?
Well, yeah, and so and the answer to that is, you can see in Colombia, for example, and what is it that the Russians say about the United States? I mean, something like they're non-agreement capable. Something, isn't that it?
So
we're seeing that absolutely borne out among U.S. allies in the region. For example, in Colombia, Iván Duque and his associates are dominated by former President Álvaro Uribe, who's a narco-terrorist gangster, and they're the people that control Colombia at the moment. They're trying to roll back the peace agreement that was negotiated between Juan Manuel Santos and the former FARC guerrilla. Now, there's a strong movement in Colombia to try and defend the peace agreement, but then what does that mean in regional terms? It means that the regional right wing in Colombia, and you see it also in Venezuela, you see it also in Nicaragua, you can see it in Bolivia, although it's not quite as blatant in Bolivia perhaps as certainly in Venezuela, the right wing are not agreement capable. They are incapable of signing an agreement and then abiding by the terms of that agreement. So in Colombia, they signed up to the peace process. They've already made some changes to it, and now they're trying to roll it back completely. That's what's going on in Colombia. In Venezuela, and we all know what happened back in last year at the beginning of what was it, 2018?
Yeah.
They were on the point of signing an enduring political settlement in the Dominican Republic, and Rex Tillerson rang up the Venezuelan opposition negotiating team and told them not to sign. And they abruptly, on the day that they'd said that they were going to turn up and sign, they turned around and walked away.
Yep.
And you can see that across the region. Here in Nicaragua, the Nicaraguan authorities are desperate to try and maintain economic and social stability. But the United States authorities, and Mike Pompeo, John Bolton, and Elliot Abrams has input, but also people like Marco Rubio, who seems to be the unofficial Secretary of State as far as Latin America is concerned. Mm-hmm. And they are putting pressure on the opposition here not to sign an agreement. So over the last month or so, the Nicaraguan opposition have been in talks with the government. They came to very specific agreements to do with releasing people, not completely in setting them free, but at least getting them out of jail and perhaps under house arrest or with a suspension of their prison sentence or some such legal figure to get them to get them out of jail, and that which is very controversial here for the majority of people in Nicaragua, who just detest the Nicaraguan opposition for the disgraceful behavior, the death and destruction, the death of around 300 people last year, and destruction to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars to public infrastructure.
Well, and their memory of the 80s, by the way.
Well, yeah. So and so what? But what happens? What has just happened over the last week? And the opposition here signed up to an agreement. They actually signed an agreement. Right. And now they're turning around and saying, oh, well, we didn't mean that. We have extra demands.
Right.
Where does that come from? And they're talking all through the talks. The government has refused to contemplate bringing forward elections. So what's happened now is that the Nicaraguan opposition signed a series of agreements, many of which are quite favorable to them, but which imply a fundamental contradiction to their position of last year, namely recognition of the authorities here as the legitimately constituted government. And then now they've turned around after signing that agreement, they're now turning around and saying, oh no, we've got to bring forward elections. And where does that come from? Of course it comes from their owners in the United States, and in the United States government, in the United States elites.
I mean, this is the same stupid game that went on in Venezuela for last year's elections. You know, you had a fragmentation of the right wing prior to this peace agreement that was brokered. If you remember when they started to discuss all of this stuff, there was one section of the opposition that was boycotting. There was another section that wanted to go ahead. And they have all these talks and they reach some sort of an agreement. And then the agreement is blown out of the water. One of the consequences is that they missed the petitioning period for people to get on the ballot, and then turn around and say, well, you know, they turn around and pretend that they're Lula, where Lula wants to run and he's in a jail cell so they can keep him from running. They're off the ballot because they didn't sign the papers to get on the ballot, and they're saying, well, the dictator won't let us run.
Well, yeah, and so what you have is, you have a right wing that is non-agreement capable, have no intention of honouring any commitments that they may enter into with, for example, the government of Evo Morales in Bolivia, the government of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, Daniel Ortega's government here in Nicaragua, or, for that matter, the government, the revolutionary government in Cuba. And we should actually point out that, and I don't think we have so far in our recent conversations, we should point out that Cuba has just gone through the most participatory democratic process that's happened anywhere in the hemisphere since certainly over the last few years, whereby they held something like, what was it, 130,000 public meetings in order to agree reforms to the constitution.
Yeah.
And then that went to a referendum, which was won overwhelmingly with support for the proposed changes. And the United States, just imagine that process happening in the United States. It would never happen.
Pete, I just came from there. As you know, I spent 10 days last week and the week before in Cuba. And people are very excited about what's happening there. The place itself feels like vibrant And the people are very enthusiastic about the future there and even the present. And there's a certain sense of pride and accomplishment over what has already happened that is palpable, practically.
Quite rightly.
Yeah, for sure. It's been earned, obviously.
So yeah, and so you've got this extraordinary capacity for democratic process on the part of revolutionary forces in Latin America, and look at what they're up against. They're up against complete people who are incompetent, people who are demented, people who actually believe their own propaganda. And here in Nicaragua, the opposition continually project themselves as, you know, the majority force in the country. But poll after poll is still showing that they have under 10% support.
Right.
You know, and you get the same in Venezuela. And look at Juan Guaido. And over the last month, it's been absolutely clear that he has practically zero support.
Yep.
And as an individual, there may be people who broadly support the opposition position, but he as an individual has practically zero support. Yep. And that he's still projected by local and U.S. media as some kind of significant political force.
Well, listen,
he's a complete nobody.
Nobody. I mean, I wish I was in D.C. when his First Lady was there, because I would have liked to have interviewed her to find out how things are going at home in the midst of all of this. But, you know, to sum it up, in essence, what we're talking about is a situation with tremendous promise on the one hand in terms of the development of democratic institutions and economic growth and such, you know, being essentially stifled right now by lying lunatics with guns. And that situation is going to have to change, and we can pick it up next week at that point, perhaps, because we are out of time. But I'd like to go into particularly some more detail about Cuba when we pick it up next week.
Right. Great.
Okay.
Thanks a million, Don.
Thank you very much, Tony. We'll speak with you again, and thanks for all the work you do.
Okay. And you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. A comedian has won the first round of Ukraine's presidential election. Volodymyr Zelensky doesn't have strong policy positions. Maybe that was his greatest appeal, though he made it clear corruption is Ukraine's biggest challenge. Fixing Ukraine's very serious problems is no laughing matter. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Adriel Consanta in London. He is a political consultant and foreign affairs analyst. Also in London, we have Alexander McCurris. He is the director and writer for TheDuran.com. And in Sonoma, California, we cross to John Jordan. He is a political strategist. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Well, one of my rules of my program is that I go to the person that got up earliest for this program, and that goes to John. Good morning. I hope you had your coffee. My first question is, what kind of game changer is this election in Ukraine? It's far from over, but we have a comedian that won the largest number of votes. And we'll talk about the people that weren't allowed to vote in this election as well. Go ahead, John, in Sonoma.
There are two primary factors to this campaign. As you pointed out, it is the anti-corruption message, which has clearly resonated. The other piece of this, which hasn't been talked about so much, is language. There are two pieces to Ukraine. While there's a strong national identity, there's a portion of the Ukraine which is Russian-speaking. And recently, Mr. Poroshenko, there's been language bills making Ukrainian the primary language, blocking Russian language websites and so forth. Mr. Zelensky is a Russian speaker, although he is a Ukrainian patriot. And he may actually, his ace in the hole here may be the fact that he does very, very well with the Russian speakers and then splits the Ukrainian speakers with Mr. Poroshenko.
Okay, Alexander Mikuris, I mean, Poroshenko's whole emphasis on the military, hating Russia, and basically creating a schismatic Orthodox Church, I guess that didn't go down too well with the electorate, because at the end of the day, if you look at the disenfranchised, the 3 million Russians living in, Ukrainians living in Russia that weren't allowed the franchise, he got, and you take into account the turnout, he got about 9% of the vote. Go ahead, Alexander.
Yeah. Well, I think that Poroshenko's whole approach has fallen very flat, because he has set himself up as the strong national leader leading Ukraine in this conflict with Russia. And it's quite clear, looking at how Ukrainians voted, that they don't want more war, that they don't like the economic crisis that Ukraine is still in. I mean, the country is still facing an industrial recession, wages are still falling, they don't like the corruption, and those are the issues that really concern them, not these national issues that Poroshenko fought the election on. And it seems to me that you're perfectly right to say that Zelensky doesn't have any very clear policy positions. So the way to understand this election is not so much as a vote for Zelensky, as a vote against Poroshenko and all the things that Poroshenko stands for, which has been the line Ukraine has been following since the events in Maidan in February 2014. So it is in effect a repudiation of that policy. Yeah. And you're perfectly correct. If those millions of Ukrainians who now in Russia had been able to vote, they would have probably voted even more for Zelensky, and Poroshenko's share of the vote would have been even less.
Adrian, let's go to you in London. It's quite remarkable, it still could happen, but it was remarkable that you didn't have Victoria Nuland visiting during this election here. I mean, there was no overt Western support of Poroshenko, though he was their candidate when he ran the first time. Go ahead in London.
Well, that's very true. I do agree with you. But I think that the last month's scandal with the defense procurement scared out Americans from being involved in supporting Mr. Poroshenko. So we have, as a previous guest rightly said, we have two-dimensional win for Mr. Zelensky. First of all is the corruption scandal related to the defense procurement related to the son of the close business partner of Mr. Poroshenko. And the other one is the fact that Mr. Zelensky is a well-known actor, and he's playing a president in his and a TV series called Servant of the People. So the main character, who is the historian, a lecturer, became a president because of the fact that he was against the corruption. So I think that those TV series are resonating with the mood and the spirit within the Ukrainian society, which doesn't want to see any longer a professional politicians who are corrupted. And they want to see an ordinary man, because Mr. Zelensky is an ordinary man. His campaign was conducted through the social media, and it strongly resonated with the young generation. So I think that it is it can be the same precedent, same as with regard to Bernie Sanders, Brexit, or Mr. Donald Trump, that people are shifting from the professional politicians to the people who are easily accessible or resonate with the general mood of the nation. And Mr. Zelensky, indeed, is resonating with the general mood of the nation.
You know, John, let's go back to California. I mean, we hear that's a very good point that we just heard here, because you had Yulia Tymoshenko, you know, obviously Poroshenko. I mean, these people have been in Ukrainian politics and governments for the last decade and a half. I mean, they're certainly known quantities here. And this is a rejection of the dominant political class because, well, they tried it with the Orange Revolution, they tried it with the Maidan, but they're still not serving up the goods, as it were, to the population because of the trade policies that Ukraine has against Russia, against its own national interest here. I think that there are other people, there are many people that are saying the status quo cannot stand. Somebody has to stand in and do it. Now, if he can create a power base and support and attract institutional support, those are all huge questions. Go ahead, in California.
Absolutely. This isn't an election which is more against something than for something. Zelensky is essentially an empty vessel in a lot of ways with poorly articulated, if at all, policy positions. But he is the character he plays on television, which is remarkable. But this is about being against the status quo. This is, in an English vernacular, American vernacular, we call it a screw-it election. This is Brexit and Trump all over again. Now, can he survive? Will there be, I think Mr. Zelensky wins this election, but how he fares is an open question because the entrenched bureaucracy and oligarchy is going to be very, very hard to remove. Now, if the Ukrainian economy were very strong, it would be harder for him to win and easier for Mr. Poroshenko, but I just don't see how Mr. Poroshenko hangs on.
Yeah, Alexander Makaris, let's go to you in London. The fat lady hasn't sung. I guess I'm going to get in a lot of trouble. I suppose that's politically incorrect to say, but I said it. We still have a round two here, and Poroshenko has enormous administrative resources, particularly in the media here. It's not beyond the realm of possibility that some event, some provocation could still come into play here.
Absolutely. I mean, it is not over. There still isn't a second round. Mr. Poroshenko knows Ukrainian politics very well. He's got all the levers that he can press and pull as president of Ukraine. He has massive resources behind him. And of course, he's also now maneuvering Zelensky into a TV debate where he will probably, as the more experienced candidate, hope to win points against Zelensky. Nonetheless, the fact remains that Zelensky has polled almost twice as many votes as Poroshenko. He's riding the rejectionist, the anti-establishment vote in Ukraine. And I would have thought that the people who voted for the third and fourth candidates, Mrs. Tymoshenko and Mr. Boyko, are more likely to support him in the second round.
Yeah.
So I think it would be an upset, a major upset, if Zelensky doesn't win. But the problem is, it's all very well to say, you know, that he's this populist candidate who's winning because he's against things. I think the problem is, given the problems of Ukraine, what you need is not someone who's just, you know, voted because he's a negative. You need somebody who has a sort of more transcendental ability to take Ukraine's problems, move them forward, has the political weight and authority to actually start to address them. And at this moment in time, I'm far from sure, that's putting it mildly, that Zelensky is that person. I'll wait and see. But, you know, I have no great hopes that he's going to be able to make much of an impression, even if he wins.
Yeah, well, the Ukrainians, their hopes have been dashed time and again ever since their independence. Anyway, let's talk about the 900-pound gorilla in the corner, and that's Igor Kolomoisky, the oligarch their sources, people report, make claims that Zelensky is very close to Kolomoisky, and we know what that means, that the oligarchs will continue to shift and mold the politics of Ukraine. The very origins of Ukraine's problems are these people and the way they run the economy for themselves, by the way. Go ahead in London.
Well, I would be very skeptical with, saying that Mr. Zelensky is a puppet of
I didn't say puppet. Go ahead.
No. I'm just relating to the,
oh, okay.
the, to, to, you know, to the newspapers here in London and in the United States, calling him a puppet. So with all due respect, I just want to make clear that the fact that the channel 1+1 owned by Mr. Kolomoisky, where the Servant of the People TV series where Mr. Zelensky is playing the main character, is one thing. Also, this program voiced a strong support with regards to its TV star. But does it mean that he'll be in the pocket of Mr. Kolomoisky? Well, I would dismiss that view, because as we probably know, in the United States, in Western Europe,
I got to jump in here. I'll let you finish when we return. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Okay, let's go back to Andrew in London here. Right before we went to the break, we were talking about the influence of Kolomoisky that could be on this candidate here. I would like to posit something for all members of the panel here. I think a lot of business interests are really sick and tired of how Poroshenko has steered the economy, and it also has a great deal to do with official Kiev, as I call it, post-Maidan Kiev, their attitude towards Russia. Well, it is really wreaked havoc on the economy. In theory, you know, you can redirect an economy, a country's economy in a different direction, but the European Union certainly is not interested in much of what Ukraine makes. And the official Kiev has denied the Russian market. It seems to me that, and I'm not singing the praises of Kolomoisky, but I'm sure people like him are saying, look, this is a dead end. We're not going to be embraced by the European Union anytime soon, considering all of its problems. There has to be some kind of rapprochement with Russia. And I know that's very hard in Ukraine right now, but there seems to be an opening at least. Adriel, in London, go ahead.
That was the very point that I've made in my report presented for the Bow Group think tank. The report was titled The Sanctions on Russia. We were saying that in order to resolve the Ukrainian problems, Ukrainian people need both Europe and Russia, because this is a country which is leaning both towards the West, which is European Union, and this is the desire of young generation, young people over there, and also West Eastern part is aligning towards the Russia. And I think that the unifier, Mr. Zelensky, Mr. Volodymyr Zelensky, is a perfect face for doing this. I mean, we have to understand that no one is capable to resolve so deeply rooted economic problems and mentality problems within the Ukrainian society within one day or even one term. So it is ridiculous to say that, oh, Mr. Poroshenko or Mr. Zelensky will resolve something. No, if there is a base, not only a political base or business base, but if is the desire within the society, then the real change can happen. And this is what is going to be. And I would just point out to my other colleagues in the panel that let us abandon the so far political conclusions or calculations which were done before Brexit and coming to the power of President Donald Trump, because they failed. And I think that the same template will be will apply to Mr. Zelensky. So it is unfair to use the old rules to the new game. The new generation, my generation, is fed up with the professional politicians and people who are well immersed within the political sphere and political class. Yeah. They need someone from the people and who can speak the language of other people, because most of the people are interested in prosperity and development of their countries. And this is what they do.
Just like everywhere else in the world here. John, you know, it would be very difficult because of the political discourse in Ukraine now and the Ukrainianization that Poroshenko has pushed so hard with his very dubious allies, these militia groups and far rightists. But it didn't serve him well in the first round of the election. And maybe this is what Zelensky and others are going to say, is that this track is not working. We have to try something else. Go ahead in California.
No, they're in Mr. Zelensky's path to victory. Remember, there's two Ukraines. There's the Russian-speaking part and there's the Ukrainian-speaking part. Mr. Zelensky is a Russian speaker, but he's also come out. He won't allow the Russian-speaking people to be marginalized, but he also speaks Ukrainian and is acceptable to the Ukrainian speakers. So he will carry and did do overwhelmingly well in the southeast Ukraine, where it is predominantly Russian-speaking, and then he'll split the other part of Ukraine with Mr. Poroshenko. Now, the big question here, the 900-pound gorilla in the room, is what does this mean for Russia and how, and also for my country, the United States? The fact of the matter is that Western Europe and the European common market has sold out the Ukraine. I mean, they're building the Nord Stream pipeline. They want Russian gas, and they're bypassing the Ukraine. The Ukraine is only being kind of used by the West as a foil to Putin. But they've really it's really been disappointing how Europe has treated Ukraine.
Well, you know, Europe has to look at its own national interests. And I would point out to our audience is that Nord Stream and South Stream and these other pipelines were only built because Ukraine showed itself to be an unreliable energy partner. And they had no choice but to do it. Okay, well, no, I mean, Ukraine destroyed the pipelines. They siphoned it. They stole gas. They didn't want to pay for it. I mean, for God's sake, I remember twice, two years in a row on New Year's, up at midnight wondering if there's going to be a gas war. That problem is resolved because Ukraine ended up being not a reliable partner. And Russia continues to ask them to be an energy partner, and they say no. So what happened? It wasn't the Europeans that let the Ukrainians holding the bag. It was the Ukrainians themselves that did it. And they have to be able to work with Russia and the European Union, because you know what? It's in between. It's always been in between. And you can't take it from one side or the other. I've been saying this ever since the Orange Revolution. Alexander Mikiris, weigh in.
Yes, I mean, I think what Mr. Zelensky needs to do is he needs to end this conflict in eastern Ukraine and sort things out with the Russians. He needs to reestablish normal commercial links with Russia so as to revive the Ukrainian economy. He has to end the conflict to bring the right-wing militias, all these various armed men that there are in Ukraine, all this very heavy nationalist atmosphere that exists in Ukraine, to bring that under control. Only if he does those things will he realistically be able to deal with these issues of corruption and of these overpowerful oligarchs, as they're called, that have such power in Ukraine, and bring Ukraine to become a normal country, as so many people in Ukraine want. Now, he's made some interesting signs. He's talked about the need for direct talks with Russia, which is a move forward. He's talked about having referendums about NATO and EU membership, which is also a step forward. I mean, Poroshenko tried to embed all these commitments in the Ukrainian constitution. He's spoken to people in Ukraine, in Russian, the Russian speakers there. He's made the right signals. The big question is, given the volatile political history in Ukraine, the extent to which so many people, so many powerful power brokers have been heavily invested in this anti-Russian policy that has been followed in Ukraine since 2014, given the large number of armed men there are in Ukraine, and given the fact that previous governments in Ukraine that have tried to tilt the country towards a more equal relationship between the EU and Russia, given that those governments have fallen, will he be able to pursue these policies? Now, on the one hand, I sense that there is an exhaustion in Ukraine, and there is a sense of disillusionment with the policies that have been followed. On the other, I come back to the point I made before. Does he have the political weight and strength and experience and ability to bring people together that he needs in order to be able to shift the ground in that way? I'm prepared to give him, you know, I hope he does, but you know, I have to be skeptical and wait and see.
Adriel, let me go back to London. I mean, I have to agree with Alexander Mikuris. I mean, you know, I know Ukraine well. I've been there many, many times. Well, I've been banned since 2014 for obvious reasons, I suppose. But I mean, it's really a country of cliques and connections. There's a great Russian word krisha, which means roof, where you basically have protection. I mean, that's how the economy is run here. I mean, I think it's wonderful that this outsider could make an entry onto the stage of national politics. But other than his light humor, and he's a very affable person, the tools that he needs to push through whatever he wants to, because we're not really sure what he wants to do, is going to be very, very difficult. The administrative workings and parliament itself will have to have goodwill toward him to have that even happen. Go ahead, in London.
Well, I think that we have to be slightly more optimistic with this regard.
That's why I like having you on. You know, that's why I like having you on.
Thank you very much. I think that Mr. Donald Trump also is not a professional politician. He's a businessman. So I think that we need to abandon this political logic of having a people who are supported by someone and something. We know that people, the professional politicians in the Ukraine, and I totally agree with you, Peter, have this stigma of being crooks. And there's no doubt about it. But the hope is that this person can wade in. Just going back to the previous commentator, I think that Mr. Zelensky is a perfect person as a descendant of Jewish people to tempt the Azov and fascist movements within the Ukraine, because it, to me, as a person also of Jewish heritage, would be insane to not being a president of Jewish descendants and not trying to tame the anti-Semitic and fascist movements who are with their nationalism against Russia, which is insane. So I put my hope in Mr. Zelensky, as other Ukrainian young people from my generation, and the time will tell whether he will deliver something or whether he will be just a puppet or a useless person put in the seat of the leader in charge of Ukraine. But I put my hope in Mr. Zelensky, and I hope that he will make such a great president as he's making
What I think we should do is that the first round is over. When we have the second round, I'd like to have all of you come back and we will discuss the final round of Ukraine's presidential election. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in London and in California. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.